No one can accuse Yuval Noah Harari of thinking small. His 2014 best-selling book, Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind, takes on 70,000 years of human history. It's been described as brilliant, myth-busting, and riveting. Our columnist Victor Dwyer has read it, and he's here to tell us what he thought of it and the Canadian companion book that he has found. Victor, welcome back.
Hello. Hi. There was a bit of a pause there. I wasn't quite sure what was happening.
I was looking for drama.
Oh, okay. I guess we got some there.
Okay. This is like, I think I want to ask you absolutely to give us a thumbnail sketch of the 70,000 years of human history that this book takes on. Kidding. How does Yuval Harari manage to cover so much ground and make it this unbelievable, critical, and popular success?
You know, it certainly is a sweeping book, and it's, you know, still on bestseller lists. He manages it, you know, by kind of really moving along. It's his attempt to kind of collate the memories that are worth keeping of who we are as a species, Homo sapiens, wise men. And it's his stab at kind of retrieving that past and also curating it as historians do. So, of course, there's lots he leaves out. There's lots of fascinating little things he tucks in. He does generally start with 70,000 years ago with what he calls the cognitive revolution. But even before that, he notes, you know, there were humans roaming the earth long before that. And we kind of forget that there were other versions of human all on the earth at the same time. We ended up surviving. And it's this kind of breathtaking biography / autobiography of our species. Central to his larger plot is his assertion that what makes us different from all the other species is the fact that Homo sapiens share myths and fictions about ourselves. Those have kind of come to define us in any given culture. So we have these sort of imagination-based rather than instinct-based cultures that, you know, for millennia now have divided people into what he calls make-believe groups arranged in hierarchies, whether it's slaves and freemen or serfs and lords or rich mm-hmm. and poor. And so these fictions and hierarchies, he says, have kind of come to help us to collaborate and to take over the world, really, and particularly since the dawn of the scientific revolution, have reverberated, you know, across the globe.
I'm also curious about his point of view through this book. Does he have a message for us? Is he prescriptive?
His big message really is that it's these kind of what he calls artificial instincts or simply imagination that have driven our species. And it's kind of what I find least satisfying about the book. I mean, he does want to distinguish sort of other species instinct from us having imagination, and that we've used this imagination and our ability to communicate, our cognitive abilities to kind of build history, the history he's telling. And, you know, in many ways, framing our kind of collective memoir that way works. Humans are pretty malleable compared to other species, and we've been able to make things as we want to make them. I mean, typical, one of his really kind of lovely little user-friendly vignettes is when he talks about how humans are born underdeveloped. And it's a result, he says, of the fact that when our branch of primate began to walk upright, that upright gait required narrow hips, and that restricted the birth canal just when our brains were kind of getting bigger and bigger and smarter. And the women who gave birth earlier in our species tended to survive when the baby's head was smaller and more malleable. They did better through the act of birth and survived to give birth again. And so one result of that, he says, is we emerge from the womb, as he very poetically puts it, not like glazed earthenware, but like molten glass from a furnace that can be spun, stretched, and shaped in surprising ways. And that certainly is true. We are a species that is able to kind of change ourselves and change those around us. But his idealism, I find, kind of leaves him in this sort of nebulous area. You know, he wants to say where we are is the result of ideas and fictions and a mentality. And for him, the scientific revolution and everything that which we continue to live in the thrall of for good and bad, it really does remain a mystery. He almost says that. And for me, that's the biggest flaw of the book, is really that the scientific revolution, which is his third big revolution after cognitive and agricultural, he never really wants to call it a capitalist revolution, which maybe I will sound like a socialist saying it, but it seems obvious to me. He doesn't seem to really ever nail the really germane notion of capitalism, which, you know, got going about 500 years ago when we really started to change things hand in hand with science, that it's this inherently propulsive, forward-thinking, sometimes blind, revolutionary way of organizing our species. And, you know, love capitalism or hate it, or like most of us, love it or hate it, I register myself among the torn. I found the book a bit nebulous when it tries to get a handle on that kind of most rousing and gripping part of the memoir. He just kind of puts a gloss on it, calls it scientific, says we have this fever, these feverish ideas of exploring and discovering, and then he kind of leaves it at that.
Well, you have made me extremely curious to hear what Canadian book you found that's a good counterpart to Sapiens. What is it?
This is a book called Memory, and it's a collection of essays. It's edited by Philippe Tortel, Mark Turan, and Margot Young, and they're all profs at the University of British Columbia.
What's the format? What's the style?
Tell
me everything.
Okay. You want it all. It apparently began with a series of discussions in the fall of 2017. It was just published this year at UBC's Peter Wall Institute for Advanced Studies. And as I understand it, it's a place that kind of brings people together from various, you know, interdisciplinary fields. And it gets them thinking about one fundamental research question. And in this case, it was the question of memory. And you know, I'd recommend this essay collection to anyone sitting down to read any book about history. Together and separately, these essays deliver these thoughtful, reflective, just nice little readable ports of entry for thinking about how we make history, how we remember our personal histories and our collective histories. And you know, if you're wondering why the heck I stumbled on a book about memory from UBC that, you know, written by a bunch of professors, maybe you're not interested, but I'll tell you anyway. It might seem a little oddball. You can see why I'd read Sapiens. Everyone in the world is. But, you know, I've been into the whole idea of memory in the past while. And part of it, I think, has to do with being a journalist, because for better or worse, journalists have kind of long delivered the first draft of history on a daily basis. And, you know, history making, that kind of history making has really come under attack lately. Who gets to claim the mantle of the official record and whose facts are taken at face value and whose story is told and recorded? And all those ideas seem so fragile right now and kind of up for grabs. And I think also I think on a personal level, and I think like a lot of people, I'm intrigued and kind of scared about what's going on with my own memory, you know, when I don't have to remember phone numbers, or I don't have to really remember what I'm doing tomorrow, my phone can tell me. And, you know, I wonder what's, like a lot of people, happening to my ability as an individual to remember.
Does it cover that kind of range?
It does,
does it
in
answer
fact.
Those questions?
Yes, one of these essays does. The introduction actually talks about, as it puts it, the billions of citizens who have subcontracted remembering to our digital device in this post-industrial age. And, you know, also just amping up a little is my mom, who's 95 and is having memory problems. And one of the essays also looks at that issue of what does it mean when an older person actually loses their memory, and what is identity if it's not memory, and do you lose your identity? So those kinds of things. And, you know, while Yuval Harari in Sapiens, he does this admirable job of exploring and remembering who we are as a species, these 28 essays, and some of them aren't essays, one's a poem, one's a chart, but most of them under like 10 pages are these little polished stones that look at the assumptions we make when we talk about memory and we talk about history, our collective memory. For instance, an essay entitled Reweaving the Past, which was written by a law professor at UBC and also by the lead writer of the final report of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And they begin their essay by quoting yet another writer, Maria Popova, who's written that, quote, memory's not the pencil with which the outline of a life is drawn, but the eraser. And that this is true both of our personal memories and of those recollections shared by the community of history. And if memory's an eraser, they ask, what and who are erased and what and who stay visible? Memory, after all, doesn't erase evenly, they write. And so in the ongoing dance between sort of past and present, we always have to be asking what is amplified and what is muted. Questions like that kind of reverberate throughout the book. And that's typical of where these essays go. They're just kind of like, what does it mean to remember? Or, I mean, other essays are much more about our almost innate determination to remember. For instance, there's fascinating, a couple of essays in here about DNA remembering. And I didn't really know this, but, you know, DNA can remember across many generations. When your grandmother was pregnant with your mother, so your mother is in the fetus at 8 weeks old, her own eggs are formed. And if your grandmother had a traumatic experience, it can affect the DNA in those eggs, and it's passed on to you another generation away. And there are studies about how that happens. And in fact, in the womb, some fetal DNA sloughs off and stays within the mother's body. And when the mother has another child, some of it comes on to that body. So your older siblings are remembered within your own DNA.
So interesting.
And all these little essays kind of pull in at all how the world is always remembering and how we're trying to remember in different ways. There's also, and I'll just cram this in, a wonderful story about Reconciliation Pole at UBC and how a totem pole is used to tell a story and to visually bring back the memory of what happened at residential schools, involving all kinds of symbolism and tales of before, kind of during and after.
The kind of acknowledging oral memory.
And very much acknowledging oral stories. And there's a couple of beautiful essays in here arguing for the importance of oral remembering, which, you know, our culture used to have a lot of. I think we're losing that too. And of course, oral tradition goes much deeper than that. But there's a real argument for saying when you don't write things down and record everything as we have done, and Yuval Harari and Sapiens says, you know, man really conquered the world when he could write and read and communicate. There are ways of orally passing things along that can actually be very deep. And in fact, the environmental ones, stories in here that look at what we're doing to the environment and the earth trying to remember, there are arguments also in those that there are many humans trying to remember too, many humans who see the earth as spiritual, many indigenous tribes, not just in Canada, but definitely in Canada, in Australia, elsewhere, that are really passing on what the earth is trying to help us to remember.
Victor, just one last question, and it is this. UBC Press, that's an academic press. What's the experience of reading these essays?
You know what?
Like?
It was so great. And, you know, I wasn't a kind of an academic at one point. I have an MA in social and political thought. And I fled academia because I couldn't understand what anybody was saying. And, you know, things were so kind of densely and arcanely written. I don't know if these people had great editors, and I don't want to undercut them by saying that. But being an editor, I did wonder, because the writing is beautiful. And they really are these condensed, lovely little gems that are easy to read and accessible. I really recommend people just tuck in, look in, and just see if there's a few of these that might, you know, really, really interest you.
Thanks, Victor.
Thank you.
Victor Dwyer. You can find his recommendations on our website, cbc.ca/thenextchapter.